This is In the Hive, a show that looks at the issues and ideas that tie the greater Salt Lake Valley together. I'm Emily Means, and today on the show, we're looking at local responses to Operation Rio Grande. Operation Rio Grande is part of a city, county, and state collaborative effort to address public safety concerns surrounding the homeless community in Salt Lake City. The $67 million plan will execute three phases over the next 2 years. Phase one focuses on public safety. Phase two looks at treatment and support for people with addiction and mental illness. And phase three intends to increase employment opportunities and training for people who have gone through the treatment phase to help them reintegrate into the community. Phase one began on August 14th and was implemented to decrease danger by removing the criminal element, the drug dealers and people with warrants, from the area. As a precursor to Operation Rio Grande, Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County initiated Operation Diversion last fall from September 29th to October 7th. The effort sought to arrest drug dealers in the area near the downtown homeless shelter and provide treatment for people with addiction and mental illness, resulting in 17 people opting for jail and 68 choosing treatment. Lessons learned from Operation Diversion informed Operation Rio Grande. According to the Department of Public Safety, in the first 3 weeks of Operation Rio Grande, 740 arrests were made. Of that total, 133 were felony arrests, 71 of those with outstanding warrants. Use of force was documented for 4 of the arrests. Last week, officials launched Phase 2 of Operation Rio Grande. Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams explained the two-pronged strategy of this second phase at a press conference on Tuesday.
So phase one of Operation Rio Grande has already moved a number of hardened criminals out of that area. We are now ready to offer expanded access to treatment for those individuals who are struggling with mental health and substance use disorders, those who are ready to get help. The news today is two-part. First, expanded treatment beds, and second, a drug court that will very quickly connect individuals in need to treatment services. With those two parts, first, we have a proposed timeline and details for a significant expansion of residential treatment capacity throughout Salt Lake County. One thing we learned from Operation Diversion is that there's a shortage of treatment to meet the needs in our state. The first handout that you have shows the service providers that will help us open beds as the funding comes online. You'll see familiar names such as First Step House, Odyssey House, who is hosting us here today, thank you, Volunteers of America, and House of Hope. These are the people who help individuals help themselves to recover, and I want to thank these people for their dedicated staff and for the life-saving work that they do in our community. Thank you to all of you. The second handout is part two of this announcement, and that is that we will begin a new specialty court that will be linked to the new treatment beds. You may recall that we proposed this court a few months ago as part of our original grant application to the state for justice reinvestment funds, and I'm pleased that this court is moving forward. It was approved by the Judicial Council on Friday and will begin accepting clients in early September. Like our existing drug court, this new specialty court will serve clients through an evidence-based program that involves judges, case managers, prosecutors, law enforcement officers, peer mentors, and legal defenders. A key aspect of this court is that we will connect eligible individuals to recovery support quickly. For the first time, clients will be screened for the program while still in jail, and in under 2 weeks, they will be connected to a structured, carefully monitored treatment program. Again, we will build on what we learned from Operation Diversion. We saw in that operation that for many individuals with this illness, structure and supervision is necessary in order for them to stay engaged and complete their treatment successfully.
With involvement at the state, county, and city levels, elected officials and law enforcement openly support Operation Rio Grande and the impact it's having on the community. But what does the public think? Today's show will feature voices of some people who are impacted by Operation Rio Grande. Those who work and live in the area, including the homeless. One group affected by Operation Rio Grande includes business owners in the Pioneer Park and Rio Grande neighborhoods, who've noticed changes in the area over the years, and in the past 3 weeks since Operation Rio Grande has been implemented.
My name is Mike Stransky. I'm owner of this building, the Henderson Block, on Second South and Fourth West, and I'm also president emeritus of GSBS Architects in Salt Lake City. We've been in here since fall of 1998.
My name is Kestrel Lidke. I own the Tin Angel Cafe with my husband, Jerry. We opened 10 years ago, last April, so we've just celebrated 10 years here by Pioneer Park.
Well, even before 1998, we were very aware of all the services that had been provided in this area. In fact, we helped with some pro bono work in getting the St. Vincent de Paul soup kitchen designed and built, and also helped subsequently later to get the Wigan Center in place. So we've had an investment here even before we bought this building. And we saw this building as a tremendous asset to Salt Lake City, and one worth continuing to save. So that's why we invested down here. And of course, we saw the future with the Gateway Center moving in. It wasn't built then, but it was anticipated. So, you know, the Catholic Community Services and later on the Road Home have all been located here, and we've always been good neighbors. And over those years, we've seen changes. We've seen the population down here change, evolve over those years. And the most disturbing part of that has been the lawless part of it, the part where there are drug dealers here and where those drug dealers are using the homeless neighbors to disguise their activities. And they're also selling drugs to people who drive down here in the, you know, in the minivan, and some even with their children, and they're buying drugs, and who knows how far those people have come. But that's activity that we've watched come and go, and in the last 3-4 years, that intensity is just grown exponentially, as everybody else can attest to. And just recently, it was as bad as it has ever been. And of course, with this new Operation Rio Grande, we're now seeing some fresh air in the community. So,
being here for 10 years kind of gives me a broad perspective about this neighborhood. And so I don't necessarily feel like it's that different now than it ever has been. That being said, it does seem that it has been steadily getting more populated. There are more people living on the streets and more people with mental illness living on the streets over the years. And really seems like it's kind of coming to a critical mass right now. But as far as its effect on our actual business, on our customers, on our staff, it's always seemed to stay pretty steady. We've never had any major problems. We've never had any crime or theft. None of our employees have ever been harassed. Maybe once in a while we've had someone come and try to spare change people on the patio or something minor like that, come and ask to use the restroom. But none of it's ever been that big of a bother.
First of all, the sanitation elements have been dealt with here. Cleaning the streets, picking up debris and of all kinds, not having people sitting on our front steps trying to sell drugs or actually shooting up. And this has happened many, many times. Sitting on our front steps or on the planters in front of our building. We've virtually seen none of that during business hours in the last 2.5 weeks.
As Operation Rio Grande has started, we've been watching, and it's been tough because I think people are afraid to come to the neighborhood. In the weeks that led up to Operation Rio Grande, there were a few violent incidences that happened at 2 and 3 in the morning, and that was keeping people away. Even though, like I said, it is actually very safe down here. A lot of the violent stuff happens at 3 in the morning and a couple blocks west of us. And for the most part, we just haven't had those kind of interactions. But people get scared. They think that their car is going to get broken into or they're going to have some kind of interaction that would be violent. And so they don't want to come down here. When it's really, I really want to put the word out, it's actually quite safe. And then since Operation Rio Grande, which I have to say I'm very happy that something's happening. There definitely needs to be some focus on this. At this point, whatever attention we get down here is good attention. Something needs to happen. But I fear that my customers don't want to come down because there are so many police in the area. It all seems a little overwhelming and intimidating. So I want to encourage people to still come down to the places near the park because we all can't last and won't be here much longer if people don't come down. And also that it is safe. People coming into the neighborhood and spending their money, spending their time adds a normalizing effect to the neighborhood, which we desperately need.
For the most part, we have no issues with anybody who happens to find themselves in a homeless situation, as long as they're respectful of our property and our person. So to help watch out for that, 3 years ago we hired our own private security company to be here essentially during business hours, and frankly just the week before Operation Rio Grande we had increased that presence here for more than, for 10 hours a day, 5 days a week. So we've assured our employees and the tenants in our building that they will have safety getting to and from their cars. So we deal with it by trying to protect our own people from the folks who might be breaking the law down here or who are mentally ill and maybe don't quite know what's going on around us. So those are all unknowns to us. We just see the mass population. But we've been here long enough. We know the people that are homeless. We know the people that are drug dealers. We know the people are having trouble with either alcohol, drugs, or mental illness. Right. There's several populations, and it's created that lawless situation that we've been dealing with. So,
I'm very happy that they're doing something down here. And the idea that they're targeting drug dealers with a police force and not drug users, I think is fabulous, and I'm glad that the ACLU is involved, standing up for people's rights, because I think that's very important. I am thankful that I feel like the drug dealers prey on the homeless, and someone should be doing something about that, and it's nice to see some effort in that direction.
Well, as I said before, we thought the future of this neighborhood is a very, very bright one. This is a great part of town to live and to have a business, and if these activities that are going on now, this Rio Grande operation and the further referral of people to proper resources continues, this is going to be a great neighborhood once again. We feel it right now. It's like we have clean air here to breathe. It's not oppressive like it's been so in the recent past.
That was Mike Stransky, President Emeritus of GSB Architects, and Kestrel Lidke, owner of Tin Angel Cafe, business owners in the Pioneer Park and Rio Grande neighborhoods. On Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday mornings on Library Square, dozens of people experiencing homelessness participate in Tai Chi with instructor and community activist Bernie Hart. Hart began the program, unfunded, last September with his wife Marita. It's been ongoing and growing since. For a bit of exercise, people experiencing homelessness come away with a burrito and a cup of coffee, and some leave with a sense of focus. I asked some of the participants for their thoughts on Operation Rio Grande and what they've experienced while it's been underway.
My name is Mitchell. I've been stopped 9 times for just petty stuff, running me for warrants. I'm part of this group here that we do the Tai Chi. We're a peaceful demonstration. Basically, we're trying to demonstrate that we are good people, but we're being harassed. We're being pushed from every place we try to go to present this peaceful movement. We're being pushed away because we're being classified as Rio Grande, step on Rio Grande, all the homeless have got to go. And it's ridiculous, man. I think the solution is they need to sit down and with some groups and listen to the people instead of, we're going to go by the drug addicts, we're going to go by, because we're not all drug addicts, we're not all dope dealers, and they need to separate that a little bit. Maybe sit down with us and talk to us instead of just step on us, you know? That's what they're doing, they're stepping on us. So I don't know what the solution is, but I'm part of a peaceful demonstration to show there's good people that are homeless. And we're not all classified as felons. It's like they keep putting it in the paper. We're gonna smash all the felons, you know? Like we're all felons or something, you know? And every time I walk across the street, I'm getting stopped, I'm getting harassed, you know? And I just wanna be able to get my life back together. And they're making it impossible for us. They're thinking this is gonna push everybody into treatment. They have 200 beds for treatment. There's probably 1,000, you know, people that need help. So, you know, they're not doing nothing but making the problem worse. They're pushing it out into the residential areas now. All these other towns are getting hit with all this problem now. I don't know what the solution is, but this is a start of making them aware that there's something that can be done.
It's Jarrett Hansen. I'm actually glad that they got the dealers and everyone off the streets that were actually causing a lot of the problems and whatnot, especially giving a bad name for the homeless and whatnot. That's just honestly my honest opinion, and I feel like that it's actually a success through phase one. Now phase two is actually in operation right now as far as the camping goes and everything like that. So phase three, I believe, should be a success as well too.
Chris, Coons. I've been stopped 6 times by the police in the last 5 days. The last time was actually adult probation and parole. I was walking down the road at 2:00 in the morning, going to the Maverick to get a drink. I suffer from insomnia. I was stopped. The first thing they said is, either of you on probation or parole? We said no. They should have walked away. So why are you stopping me? Said, it looked like you were making a drug deal. Told him, well, we're not. We're going to get a drink. He walked over and started patting my pockets. I says, what are you doing? Knocked his hand away. He says, I have a right to search you for weapons. I says, you have no right to even talk to me. What is your badge number? This is an illegal search. He turned away from me and started harassing my friend. I walked away. All 6 times, I've never been cited. Have nothing wrong. They run me for my warrants, harass me, bother me, and let me go. I've been bothered for sleeping in the park, which I thought it was okay to lay down and take a nap in the park. It's harassment. They have nothing better to do. So, yeah, it's just wrong. They tried this about a year ago, and they took and rounded everybody up instead of taking them to jail. They took them to the police station and offered them a treatment program or jail. They're like, go to jail or join the army, you know? These people definitely want treatment, but it was ineffective treatment. Half of those people are back on the street right now. They didn't follow through. They didn't continue. These people need some help. Anybody that is homeless is mentally ill. We have failed to assimilate. We are not. I was an electrician, professional electrician for 30 years. Excellent career. And had some personal problems with my child, my family. That drove my job down the hill. Next thing you know, my apprentice lit my job on fire, burned 61 jobs to the ground, or 61 apartments to the ground. And I don't want to work no more. I do not want to tell people what to do. And just have basically crawled a shell. I don't want a career. I just want to survive, work minimum wage jobs, work temporary jobs, get by. But yeah, this doesn't help. They come by and harass you. They keep you up at night. You can't get to work. It's the wrong help.
Operation Rio Grande and its impact on West Side communities was the action item of the Poplar Grove Neighborhood Alliance's monthly meeting, held on Friday, August 25th in the Social Hall of St. Patrick's Catholic Church. Utah House Speaker Greg Hughes, Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski, and Salt Lake City Police Chief Mike Brown were among the officials who attended. Residents on the west side of Salt Lake, including the Poplar Grove, Ballpark, and Fair Park neighborhoods, have reported more camping in public parks, prostitution on public streets, and needles and drug paraphernalia on playgrounds since phase one of Operation Rio Grande began. For 90 minutes, about 50 West Side residents asked questions and voiced concerns against a backdrop of fans to combat the almost 90-degree heat in the building. Here's an excerpt from the evening featuring questions answered by Speaker Hughes.
Well, I'd like to know how it was that you all set your priorities as you were planning this operation. I'd like to know why it was that it was so easy to find 300 jail cells overnight, but 37 treatment beds that were supposed to start coming available last week. I don't know if any of them are open yet. I heard you make the comment that there was supposed to be 200 beds coming on later this year. I want to know, do we have any guarantees of that? You said it was hard work. Is that, can you promise us that we're going to get at least that many? Why are we only getting a third of treatment beds compared to the number of arrests we've made? Why is it that we hear so much about you're primarily going after this dangerous criminal element when we just learned tonight that 80-85% were not even felony arrests? And I want to know why there was no transparency in the planning of this. Why was there no community outreach beforehand? Why couldn't we all have voiced our opinion on this before you went in and started making these mass arrests and scattering people all over the city?
The jail beds are easier to, first off, we haven't had capacity. And so you saw where we have with jail, they call them booking restrictions. So police officers were not able to, for any crime they saw, be able to take someone to jail. We on the state side had to go find with other county jails around the state open or jail beds that would be available so that we could create that capacity here in Salt Lake County in the Salt Lake County Jail. That's government to government beds and facilities where we're working with different counties to do it. The treatment beds are private entities. And it's much more difficult to tell a private entity to have all their beds prepared and ready at the same time as it is for the state of Utah and the different counties to work in the jail bed side. So it's a good distinction that the jail beds, and they've not been easy to find as we well know, but they were, we could accommodate that quicker because it was government to government. In the treatment bed side, we're talking private providers, and there are some that are under construction, and the reason there's a lag is that they're building those. And to the question of what's the guarantee, we as a state, the Lieutenant Governor, myself, we have a Medicaid expansion waiver that we have been told is going to come in, but if it were not to, we as a state are committed to that, and that's the comfort level that the private providers have heard from us and our commitment level to begin to find that capacity for those treatment beds. So there's a lag there. Why didn't we tell everyone? Because we're not going to tell the most high traffic criminals exactly what we're going to do, and we're not going to say, hey, we're going to start watching the people that are committing these crimes and selling these spice cigarettes at 100 miles an hour and the balloons of heroin, and we're going to go on this day and we're going to do it this way. We're not going to do that. It's going to be in the element of the law enforcement. And what we told the chief and the commissioner was we were not going to let the politics interfere with effective law enforcement. And this was not a sweep of people from one side of the street to the next. They truly did identify the most, the highest traffickers and those that were the most important to apprehend. And there was a priority to that. And that's something that you can't put neon lights around. But I do think it was effective. And I think if you look at the streetscape there, and from what I've heard from the people that are there, they feel safer. The meals at St. Vincent's did not go down, but maybe the people that were able to come and get a meal felt safer. And so some of those services didn't change, but the people that might have been camping or not ready to be in that area were coming to that area. So I think those are the answers of why we didn't have a big public hearing and maybe more transparency to the law enforcement effort as it started, and the difference between finding those treatment beds and its difficulty, but its commitment from the state that we're going to get those, and why the jail beds were, we could work as a government a little bit more efficiently together.
Thank you.
My name's Amy Hawkins, I'm vice chair of the Ballpark Community Council. Some of you know who I am, but my neighborhood faces a lot of the same problems that your neighborhood faces. We have low budget motels in our neighborhood, and a lot of those are associated with the same problems that you have. Kids find needles in yards, and we regularly see sex work that's happening in parked cars along the streets where families live, and that's a big problem. I wanted to ask a question specifically about the timeline of Operation Rio Grande and in relationship to something that I've asked over and over at community council meetings, and I haven't gotten a great answer to yet. And it's about how the end of Operation Rio Grande seems to be coinciding with the closing of the road home in June 2019. And I'm deeply concerned about that, both from a crime perspective, a ripple effect perspective, and a social justice perspective. We live in a city where the temperatures go to 105 degrees and down to 5 degrees. If there is not an emergency, low barrier, overflow shelter for the homeless in our city, people will die. And we will also see additional camping and crime being pushed out to our neighborhoods. Why haven't we heard any conversation about a replacement for the road home? I applaud your efforts. Operation Rio Grande, I applaud it. I applaud the lack of violence associated with it. And I'm extremely excited to see more affordable housing come online and transitional housing come online. But I am deeply concerned. What is going to happen when the road home closes? And what is going to happen when the road home closes at the same time that your operation is finishing?
That's a great question. Okay. So, and this is why I'm glad we're having this meeting, because this is an incredibly important question. So this is what we face. We put in statute that we are going to close the road home in June of 2019. If there's 1,000 people at the road home, and to your point, ma'am, if you don't have another place to go, that statute's not worth the paper it's printed on, because you can't kick people out on the curb. Here is the long-range plan. We have put money towards resource centers that are to take the population that is currently residing at the road home and bed for bed, be able to find accommodations for those people at these resource centers. But here's what the legislation didn't do. It didn't contemplate how we would see the numbers that could be up as high as 2,100 people shrink down to the 700 that it has to be. So the way that we are trying, the reason this whole Rio Grande effort is going on is it's two-pronged. We want to lower the number of the people that are in that area that are the criminals. We want to see if there's 2,100 people there in the summertime, or whatever number that is, we want to see those go to some other area where, you know, the economies of scale or whatever motivates drug cartels to come into a community and prey upon the vulnerable. We don't want Utah to be an attractive place, and we do think that they will move on once our attention does not wane and we stay focused on this. To the other part, on the treatment side, we want to see these beds come online, so we're shrinking the population down there by addressing the criminal element and the organized criminal element. We're also looking to shrink the number by providing the treatment beds and the transitional housing, because we have to get to the number of 700 people who would, bed for bed, be able to go into the resource centers so that we're not kicking people to the curb or sending them out with nowhere to go. And this is that's why this effort coincides with those 2 years, because you've got to have that number be one that you're going to be able to access to those resource centers. And we did not have, I believe, a viable plan to see those numbers match. So it is really to address the exact issues you're talking about, to get the people that are experiencing homelessness to those resource centers, and making sure we're not turning anyone away with nowhere to go.
If you've been down to the Rio Grande neighborhood recently, what have you noticed? Weigh in at the KCPW Facebook page, KCPW 88.3, or feel free to email us at comments@kcpw.org with your feedback and questions. Thanks to the KCPW team for their support of this show, and thank you for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this program on our website, kcpw.org. Up next is Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Emily Means. Thanks for listening.